Welcome to the Hamilton Spectator Newsroom Insider. I'm David Crosby. Today we are discussing the case of a Hamiltonian connected to one of the largest security compromises in online history. Kareem Baratov, a 22-year-old Ancaster man, has been arrested and charged with computer hacking, economic espionage, and other crimes in connection with the 2014 Yahoo hack, in which over 500 million email accounts were compromised. In a statement released by Yahoo's chief information security officer in September, the pilfered information included names, email addresses, telephone numbers, dates of birth, hashed passwords, and, in some cases, encrypted or unencrypted security questions and answers. The United States Department of Justice has indicted two Russian spies employed by the FSB with hacking, economic espionage, trade secret theft, wire fraud, and identity theft. This is a historic first, charges levied against active Russian cyber intelligence agents by the U.S. government. As America and Russia have no formal extradition agreement, however, the case is likely to focus on Mr. Baratov, the only suspect to be arrested thus far. The indictment claims that after a Russian hacker gained access to the Yahoo database, the two FSB agents hired Mr. Baratov to use that information to spearfish those accounts' owners in order to gain access to their email or other online accounts. Spearfishing is the practice of sending an email that appears to be from a contact or organization that you know, asking you to provide more information about yourself. This can be as obvious as clicking a link and submitting a password, or as seemingly innocuous as providing details about your name, address, or date of birth. This information is then used to gain access to an online account, often through the perennially helpful forgot password feature. The Toronto Star reports that Baratov was allegedly paid to obtain unauthorized access to more than 80 email accounts, including 50 Google accounts. He generally charged about $100 US per account and was paid at least $1,000 in money and other things of value between April 2015 and 2016, according to the indictment. Baratov was arrested March 14th at his Ancaster home under the Extradition Act at the request of American authorities and handed over to the RCMP. Here was the scene outside of John Sapinka Courthouse, Friday afternoon.
What the purpose of today is strictly to confirm a bail hearing that's been set for April 5th. That bail hearing has been coordinated with the Crown Prosecution. Additionally, the extradition hearing will be scheduled at a later date. That depends on the U.S. government, how they wish to proceed with that. Our essential goal is to get Mr. Baratov out. He is a 22-year-old entrepreneur, successful at what he does. The comments that were made before tie him to Donald Trump and you know, Russian spies, ridiculous, unfounded. So any of those comments prior to, like I said, ignore. I've had strict instructions by the family. After today, we were going to be obtaining a publication ban, so we're not allowed to disclose anything further. Procedure is procedure, and that's all we really can say.
We're joined now by Spectator reporter Natalie Patton to discuss the story. So Natalie, you were down at court today where Baratov appeared via video.
Yes, so he was on a video screen wearing an orange jumpsuit, glasses, staring straight ahead. He didn't say anything. The whole court process was over in probably about 8 minutes. It was two of his lawyers who were speaking to the judge.
And did you get a chance to speak to the lawyers at all?
Yeah, so the one lawyer, Amadeo DiCarlo, he's a Toronto lawyer who's representing Baratov. He spoke to reporters before the appearance. He did so because he was seeking a publication ban, which the judge did not approve at this point in time. But he spoke to reporters. He described his client as a 22-year-old entrepreneur who's very successful at what he does, but he declined to state what Baratov does and what he did to get his money. He said that, as well as what kind of person Baratov is, will come out all in due time.
Can you talk about that?
You will get to know Kareem Baratov.
Sir, do you...
Not in the way that people are portraying him, nor the media.
Would you call him a computer analyst?
I cannot describe what Kareem does, nor who he is, until the time is right.
Why
the public will know.
The other lawyer, Deepak
Proudcorn?
Yes. He spoke afterwards on the front steps of the courthouse, and he was more so speaking from a procedural standpoint. So he explained that they sought the publication ban. The judge said not at this time, but they could try again before the bail hearing, which is scheduled for April 5th.
So the issue with the publication ban was that it was too soon?
Yeah, I mean, they were seeking a publication ban because because of the evidence, essentially, because of the record which contains the evidence pertaining to this case. The judge, Justice Carpenter Gunn, basically said at this time there was not enough of a case to grant a publication ban.
Okay.
So it's just the start of the extradition process, which is likely to last several months. I mean, the bail hearing has been scheduled for April 5th, but an extradition hearing has not been scheduled yet. The bail hearing itself is expected to take at least a full day, we've been told, and that likely four witnesses will be called. Not sure who those witnesses are.
And did you have any sense of where Mr. Paratov is at this point?
It's my understanding that he is in Barton Jail.
Okay.
That wasn't confirmed today, but earlier in the week, one of my colleagues phoned and asked about visiting hours, and they were told that Mr. Baratov was at Barton and is part of one group of visiting hours, which is how the schedule works at the jail. So.
Right.
So that's, he definitely was in jail. We saw by video today, so.
Okay. So earlier this week, you had gone up to Ancaster, where Mr. Baratov was living.
Yeah, so yesterday, on Thursday, I sort of made my rounds. We started at Chambers Drive address, which is where Mr. Baratov allegedly lives. It's where it's listed in property records.
Okay.
All quiet there. The home had been listed for sale.
Oh, really?
Unsure whether it still is. His real estate agent hung up when I phoned him. So I couldn't confirm that, but there was no sign on the front lawn. There looked like there was a light on in the front foyer, but other than that, all was quiet. We also went to a home on Moreland Crescent, which is about a 3-minute drive away. And the individuals, two individuals who are listed on the property records for Baratov's Chambers Drive home, are listed on the property records for this Moreland home. I went and knocked on the door, and no one answered, so I left my card. No one's called me back yet, but still hopeful. And I spoke to some neighbors in that area. They said that one neighbor actually said he thought Mr. Baratov lived there because he would always see his blue Lamborghini parked in the driveway.
Right.
He had limited interactions with him. He said he would see him walking up and down the street with friends in the evening, and he was always pleasant, said hello.
This is at the Moreland house, sorry.
This is at the Moreland house, yeah, which is not the home registered to Mr. Baratov, but the home registered to the two people who are listed on the property records for Mr. Baratov's home.
Some kind of relation there.
Yeah, I'm being a little bit vague because we don't totally know what the relation is. The last name is Togberganov.
Okay.
That name is linked to one of Baratov's aliases.
All right. So,
appears to be some kind of connection. I mean, I probably wouldn't just help someone out with a mortgage, be a co-signer if I didn't have a connection with him, but it's unclear what exactly that connection is. So yeah, on Moreland Drive, another neighbor mentioned that he had had a conversation with the man who lives in the home. He did not know Baratov himself, but he said that this man had said his son was involved in online investing and web design.
Okay.
But yeah, it didn't really seem like anyone knew him very well. And then we headed over to another address a bit further away in Ancaster, maybe about a 10-minute drive away, where we believe Baratov and his family may have lived at one time, according to property records. But neighbors there either weren't home or didn't want to talk. So,
understandably, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people have sort of expressed apprehension about attaching their name to something that involves Russian hacking.
And the U.S. federal government. I mean, these are
substantial
charges.
Totally. So, so I can understand that. But it's very helpful, obviously, talking to neighbors and, you know, former classmates or whoever might have known Beritov or his family at one point, because obviously these allegations are quite startling.
Absolutely.
So to know a bit more about what he was like growing up or through his high school years might help paint a clearer picture, or maybe a more broad or wholesome picture of what Mr. Beritov was like and is like, and what happened leading up to the time of these allegations.
So what is that document specifically?
Okay, so we obtained from court today, it's formally titled The Application Record for Provisional Arrest Warrant. So it's court documents filed by the Attorney General of Canada on behalf of the United States. And it sort of details all of the evidence of the case. So
the grant for extradition.
Pretty well, okay. Yeah. So it's a 35-page document. It calls Mr. Beritov a hacker for hire. It says he acted as a hacker for hire between 2014 and December 2016. And it also calls him a danger to the community. Goes on to detail some of the allegations. So, for example, that he engaged in spear phishing. So he was sending out emails that looked trustworthy to get people to input their login information. He also has been called a significant flight risk, in particular because his hacking can be done from anywhere in the world, the document says. So, he would be able to quickly destroy evidence on the run. That's a direct quote from the document. And it would allow him to continue with the crimes, quote unquote, wherever he might be. So, yeah, so it also talks a bit about what they call his lavish lifestyle, which is something I think we've heard a lot of, in particular with sports cars. So I mentioned that the one Moreland Crescent neighbor thought that Mr. Beritov lived in that home because his blue Lamborghini was parked there.
Okay.
The document mentions that he previously owned a Lamborghini or previously had a Lamborghini, but now has an Aston Martin and a Mercedes. So, we've heard a lot of hearsay about Mr. Beritov driving around the neighborhood in his sports cars, and that's sort of one common thread, I think, that we're hearing from people when they're asked to describe whether they knew him or what they knew about him.
Which, to be clear, is absolutely hearsay, and in some ways almost fuels this initial defense of one of his lawyers that this was, for whatever reason, a targeted smear campaign.
Totally. I mean, his lawyers deny the government allegations, and they say, you know, that the media is not doing Mr. Beritov any favors by talking to people who say they knew him, or by, you know, painting this picture of him based on what's portrayed on social media accounts like Facebook and Instagram, mm-hmm. because Mr. Beritov has quite a detailed Facebook and Instagram page that's open for people to see. Again, those are all posts, I mean, within sort of no context. So we're reading into it what we will, I guess. We're reading into it what we won't. But the lavish lifestyle bit in particular, that is a quote taken directly from the application record for provisional arrest.
Okay.
And they did specifically detail the cars. But, I mean, like you said, what that means is yet to be seen.
Okay, so what can you tell me about the extradition process?
Okay, so the extradition process, from speaking to a criminal lawyer who practices extradition law, my understanding is that it can take several months. How it starts is with court appearances, like what's been happening so far.
Right.
If the client is seeking bail, which is happening in this case, a bail hearing is scheduled. And then an actual extradition hearing would be scheduled. So that is something that's heard before a judge. It is what some call a paper trial, which means that it is strictly based on a collection of documents brought forward that outlines a case. You're not going to hear from witnesses. So that does mean that it could be scheduled sooner than if you're trying to arrange a case where you had to coordinate a whole bunch of witnesses' schedules, for instance.
Or jury.
That's right. Jury, too. Yeah. So when I asked the lawyer who I spoke with, Daniel Brown, he's a Toronto extradition lawyer, he said that the hearing itself could be scheduled within a few months' time. I believe it actually has to be scheduled within 90 days' time.
Okay.
He said there are a number of what he called post-hearing applications that could be brought forward if a judge does order extradition, which could delay the process, sometimes by years. Because, for example, a person who has been ordered to be extradited, they could appeal to the ministry, who would then, or I guess the minister in particular, who would then have to review it, and that can take a year in itself before a decision is issued. So, so depending on how it goes, it's so fresh right now. Like I said, the bail hearing hasn't even taken place. That's scheduled to take place in a few weeks. So hopefully we'll have a better sense then of what is to come.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time to sit down and talk to me about this.
Yeah, thanks for having me.